From time to time on the morning show, we have talked about the world of medicine and medical care, the important work of doctors and nurses and other caregivers. But I don't know that we have ever talked about medicine and medical care in quite the way that we're going to for the next few minutes. We are going to be talking today with Dr. Susan Partovi, who practices what is sometimes called homeless medicine or street medicine. At least that is a great deal of what she does in her medical practice, dealing with persons who are living with homelessness, with very serious poverty, often with very serious mental illness as well, and in a sense a cavalcade of challenges that often exacerbate each and create really, really difficult situations and exceptional suffering. And Dr. Susan Partovi has really worked tirelessly with this population and has written about some of her experiences in a remarkable book called Renegade MD, A Doctor's Stories from the Street. If by chance you saw a film a couple years ago called Tell It Like a Woman, then you saw her portrayed on screen by actress Marcia Gay Harden. And I so appreciate the great honesty with which Dr. Partovi has written this book. And as we read it, we find maybe some of our careless assumptions about this particular population very much brought into question. And one comes away with tremendous admiration for anyone who, like Dr. Partovi, devotes time and energy and passion and compassion to working with this population. The book, again, is Renegade MD. And Dr. Susan Partovi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Ah, thank you so much for having me. It's very lovely to be with all of you.
I'm really glad we have this opportunity. One of the things that is interesting about your book, which of course focuses mostly on your experience as a doctor, is that it does touch a bit on your own childhood, a childhood and a family situation that was a little bit difficult. And you write at one point, in my family, I sometimes felt unloved and unheard. And I wanted to begin there just because I wonder to what extent you trace a line between, you know, kind of the hurts and frustrations of growing up in the family that you did with this life that you are living now. And can you trace kind of a connection between the difficult start of your life and what you're doing now?
Yeah, and, you know, as an adult, I've kind of come to terms with, you know, how I was raised. It was, you know, I think my parents did the best that they could. and I, you know, I don't harbor ill will towards them. But there wasn't a lot of expressed love, let's say. And so it made me wonder as a kid, like, huh, am I even lovable? And I think that permeates, you know, throughout my life. But, you know, I'm kind of at a point in time where I can go, okay, wait, that's not true. That's just kind of this automatic way of thinking. I wouldn't call it a trauma per se, but it definitely dealt with insecurities and questions about my purposefulness in life. And so I think finding a purpose in life and really making a difference in the world is kind of what made me feel like, okay, you know, I'm on the right path. So I kind of had to, you know, figure things out for myself, so to speak.
One of the things I like as you describe some of your first experiences in terms of working with others is that it was, in a sense, a way to shake yourself loose of what was at least kind of the way you characterize, you know, a young person's preoccupation with a lot of things that didn't matter. And kind of a self-absorption that certainly was not unique to you. But a lot of people never do shake off that sense of self-absorption and being worried first and foremost about their own needs and comforts. Something, in a sense, liberated you from that.
Well, part of it is just, I mean, that's the normal trajectory of, you know, childhood, teenageism, early, you know, early adulthood, right? Of trying to, you know, you start making that transition from being self-absorbed to, you know, others absorbed. I forgot the question.
Just how you, but what is it that kind of took you in such a dramatic direction away from that?
You know, I was raised in a Jewish family, and I was exposed to like a Christian youth group, and so I became really interested in Christianity and reading about Jesus and the Bible, and you know that was kind of the first time of really looking at someone who is very others oriented, right? And then my church went to Mexico for Easter break to build houses. This is while I was in high school. And so that was really, and we went to what we call the dump site, because it was literally a hill of trash where people were squatting. And it was really the first time where I saw just abject poverty. And so that was a big turning point for me, where I was like, okay, this isn't okay with me. You know, I need to be doing something. And so, you know, part of the book is really to inspire people to look at their own lives and say, okay, what can you pick in the world that where you can say, you know what, this isn't okay with me, or this doesn't work for me, or I want to do something about this. And it's about, you know, picking a passion, choosing that passion. And, you know, it's not easy, and it can be really frustrating, but it's kind of like the juice of, you know, your life. It makes your life meaningful, purposeful. So, you know, that's my kind of overall theme is, you know, pick a passion, and then whatever that passion is, you're caring about other people or animals, if that's your passion, you're having compassion for them, you're doing it with a sense of conscientiousness, meaning you're really looking into what you're doing, and you're going that extra mile. And then you're accepting people for where they're at. And that, I think, is the main ingredient that really allows people to feel respected and to maybe feel like, oh, maybe I am worthy of, you know, love. Maybe I am worthy of, you know, having some aid or you know, getting help. And so,
We're speaking with Dr. Susan Partovi about her book, Renegade MD, A Doctor's Stories from the Streets. She has practiced what we might think of as street medicine and homeless medicine, giving all kinds of help to people experiencing homelessness and learning a whole lot of lessons along the way. One of the things I really especially appreciate about your book is how you share with us some of what you have learned, and in particular, the way in which you have come to a kind of a deeper understanding about certain matters that we might just kind of adopt very sort of simplistic perspectives. For instance, in one chapter in which you talk about a certain patient named Antonio. This is in a chapter called First Patient of the Day. He is someone who is severely diabetic, who when he comes in to see a doctor for the first time in 4 or 5 years, he's actually experiencing gangrene and cellulitis and all kinds of very serious complications from his diabetes. And
right.
you, on a form, after giving it a bit of thought, check off the box, neglect, or neglected, right. that he is being neglected by his brother or whatever the family member is who had finally brought him in. And then you begin thinking more about that and whether or not that, in fact, is appropriate an appropriate designation in this case. Tell us more about that whole matter of neglect, what it means to neglect a loved one, and the more maybe kind of nuanced or deeper understanding you came to have about this matter.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking that. So, yeah, you know, early in my career, I'm like, well, he's living with his brother. His brother should be, you know, taking better care of him. And ironically or serendipitously, about 10 years later, I ended up having to take care of my sister, who at one point was a functioning adult and then developed a very, very rapid, severe, rare type of early onset dementia. And how difficult it is to take care of an adult who can't take care of themselves. And I also had to take care of my mom as she got older and developed Alzheimer's. There's a lot of nuances involved because you want to maintain respect because they don't want to be treated like a child, but at the same time, you want to take care of them. And you can't give up on them. You know, some people give up on their loved ones, you know, no faults of their own, but just because it's so difficult to care for them. And that's, you know, probably how they end up in the streets. But it's extremely difficult to take care of a gravely disabled adult loved one. And so I learned over time, you know, it's really hard to get them to do anything that, you know, that keeps them safe, you know. And so, you know, by the end of the article, I'm like, okay, this guy was probably his hero. It's like he was just probably doing the best that he could. You know, he got him in, he kept him clean. He cut his beard and he came in, you know, clean and unfortunately probably refused to take any medications for his diabetes. And, you know, probably the loved one was just, you know, just exasperated, you know, by having to take care of him and was doing the best that he could. So, and then I start talking about like the societal neglect, you know, like why is it that I'm criticizing this loved one who's doing the best that he can to take care of his loved one? And yet, you know, I'm not having our society, our community held more responsibly, you know. So I go on to like, you know, when I rollerblade on the boardwalk in Santa Monica and I see, you know, the same gentleman who looks ill, you know, as I whiz by on my rollerblades, like who's responsible for him? You know, is there a box on neglect that I can check off for the city of Santa Monica or the county of Los Angeles or the state of California or the country of the United States? So, you know, I kind of start pondering about the whole idea of neglect as a society.
Of course, this also really touches on something that you explore later in the book, this whole matter of free will. And you have really come to have grave concerns about the way in which our country right now approaches this matter of free will. You say at one point, holding too strongly to the sanctity of free will is harming our mentally ill. You've seen with your own eyes the terrible suffering that ensues when, in a sense, people who are not in a position to make any kind of rational decisions about their own well-being are, in a sense, left to their own neglect, if you will, because of this matter of of free will. How would you have us frame this concept of free will differently from the way that it is being approached right now, at least in general?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And that's really what really breaks my heart. When you see it up and close and you see it on the streets, someone who cannot take care of themselves, like if I had not stepped in to take care of my mother and sister, they would have been in the streets for sure. And so, you know, what is the difference, you know, when we have our loved ones, our parents who suffer from dementia, you know, we never talk about that, you know, if they have to go into a home or memory care, place or a place that, you know, keeps them safe and healthy because maybe we can't take care of them ourselves. We don't backlash against those people and go, oh, you're taking away their free will. We're taking care of our loved ones. And so I'd like people to see that when someone is in such a state that they're not capable of taking care of themselves, and it really doesn't matter why, but most of the time it's because of a severe mental illness, but who knows, it could be because it's dementia. I've found several people on the streets who were there because of their dementia. It could be a medical condition. It could be even substance use. It doesn't matter. We need to take care of them. It's a medically necessary treatment, basically, is what we call it. And the bigger umbrella is taking care of our loved ones.
Mm.
So if you think of a child, you know, and God forbid they need chemotherapy and they're tantruming that they don't want it, you're going to do everything in your power. You know, you might work on them. You might show them books. You might, you know, go over some material, watch a cartoon about it. I don't know, you know. But in the long run, you're not going to let your child decide what's ultimately best for them. And I'm not saying that an adult with severe mental illness is a child, but their rational capabilities or their executive functioning is at the level, a developmental level of a child.
Mm.
And so that's another way of thinking about it. And so we see these people in the streets and we've normalized it. And yet if this was your brother or your sister or your own child, you would do everything in your power to make sure that that doesn't happen. And when I meet especially parents of adult children who have severe mental illness, a lot of them have died. And it's so heart-wrenching. And it's they die because they're like walking in the middle of the street and they got hit by a car or they overdosed or they had a simple medical condition that they refused to go to the hospital and it festered and then they died from it. I mean, it's crazy that we let that happen.
Hmm. You mention at one point in the book the passage of the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, which, in a word, ended involuntary commitment of people with mental health disorders. If you could, would you rescind that?
No, it's not. It didn't end it. It just created laws around it. And so I want to be clear that we're not talking about recreating the asylums and the institutions. Like, that's not the way we want to care for our loved ones, right? But we do want to create something that we call housing that heals. And we're looking at the spectrum of care that people need at different points of their life. So there might be a point in their life where they're so disabled, kind of like when you have a heart attack, you go into the ICU, you know, so it's kind of the same thing. So like an intensive care unit for your severe mental illness. And, you know, that's not the rest of your life, but you need some intensive care. And then if we can continue, you know, if you had a heart attack, sometimes you need rehab. And so, you know, we can equate that to like a step down version. And so we need, you know, a place where someone can stabilize, but they're not as acute as they were in the beginning. And then depending on where they land, some people, you know, can go on and live, you know, quote unquote, normal lives, you know, while they're, you know, can go on to be a lawyer or a doctor. But some people, and especially the older they get living with their psychiatric condition, it causes brain damage, and it allows them to not revert back to quote unquote normal. And so they, even though they are stabilized on medication, they still need a lot of support in order to, you know, let them live purposefully and thrive. And so that's what my group of advocates that we are calling for is like having that full spectrum available. And so the Latimer Pettis Short Act was California's act to create a law around how to conserve someone and also how to stabilize them. It is involuntary commitment, and it's not something that we think everyone should go through. But some people, the really, you know, again, super dupers, really need to be in an equivalent of an ICU and then rehab until they can get stable and see, you know, where they can live and live a purposeful life. So no, I'm not against it, but it's brought a lot of barriers to treatment. And luckily, the definition got expanded for the first time in over 50 years last year through a statute that was approved by the governor. So now California grave disability is defined as someone who's unable to provide for food, clothing, or shelter, or safety, or medical conditions. So before it was just the first three. So, you know, if you can imagine someone who's severely mentally ill on dialysis, and they believe that the diacylate that's going in their system is poisoned, and so they don't want to go to their dialysis. So, you know, when the statute becomes implemented, you know, we can now say, all right, you know, we're gonna hospitalize you in an intensive care situation, try to get you stable, and then, you know, hopefully they'll come to the rational thinking that they do need the dialysis. And this isn't for people who have been suffering and, you know, and are done with their terminal illness. You know, we're not talking about that kind of people. We're talking about, you know, people who normally should be given a chance to be happy and purposeful in their lives. And when you're in the midst of your demons and your delusions and your hallucinations, and it's horrific to watch these people have, you know, these issues. And, you know, you want them to stop suffering. Like when you're seeing someone suffer, sometimes there is a greater good to what their rational mind is saying. And so it's about taking care of someone who just at that point in time and maybe it'll last a lifetime, but they need to be taken care of, and we need to be aggressive about it. We have to look at it like it's an emergency,
right?
And go to the ICU. It's like that.
I want to give you a chance to explain the way, and I think our listeners will probably already have some notion of it, but why the book is titled Renegade MD. What are the most significant ways in which you have been a renegade in the medical profession, a renegade in the way that you have gone about serving this particular population?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, some people might think that renegade's about, like, breaking rules and, you know, being kind of this, you know, ball buster, you know, badass, but, you know, in a negative way. But the way I describe it, it's the person who's going that extra mile, who's doing whatever it takes. And it's kind of beyond the norms of what you think normal doctoring should be, right? And so I call it Renegade MD because I practice medicine with that whatever it takes philosophy. This one time I was like, one of my bosses, you know, kind of said to me, you know, we're not a whatever it takes agency. And I'm like, oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that. Thanks for letting me know that. because that's who I am, you know. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be pissing people off to be persistent about someone's healthcare. But I can be pretty persistent especially when it comes to a life, you know, a life and death situation. And so I've driven patients to the emergency room. You know, I'll buy them cigarettes, buy them food. You know, these aren't, you know, it's a whatever, you know, what is it going to take to get you to trust me, you know? Hmm. And so if someone's coming to me and I have an example of a patient of mine I've known for 10 years, and he's a longtime opioid user. And at first, and this is kind of a common scenario where a lot of people were injecting heroin, have since switched to smoking meth and fentanyl together. And the fentanyl, of course, has increased our overdoses and death rates, especially in people experiencing homelessness. So in that sense, it's really become an epidemic. And this one gentleman, he started getting severe mental illness, most likely from the meth use. So 40% of people using meth can have psychotic symptoms. And so that's one thing that we've been seeing, especially in Skid Row, because meth is so rampant, that the people are becoming psychotic, and it looks a lot like schizophrenia. And so he was, because I had a relationship with him, he was able to say, you know, can I have help with my voices? And, you know, he'd also was trying to get off opiates kind of on and off. And so you have to be flexible and accept where they're at, that he wasn't, sometimes he wanted to get off opiates, sometimes he didn't. And you just had to keep being a support person for him and not making him feel bad for doing something that was unhealthy for him. So that's really the key of harm reduction. So at one point, you know, let's fast forward a couple of years. He's on an antipsychotic. He's doing really well mentally, but he's still using fentanyl, and he's overdosing like 2-3 times a week. Now he's overdosing in front of the Center for Harm Reduction, so, you know, where the staff knows how to reverse overdoses. So in a sense, he's being rational in about his safety. So he knows he has a history of overdoses, so he's going to use in a public place, and he's able to make that safe decision. Now people who are listening to me are probably freaking out, like, why are you advocating for this guy's fentanyl use? And it's not that I'm advocating, I'm just not rejecting him. I'm not rejecting his, you know, his illnesses, and addiction is an illness. And so I'm keeping an open space available for him to come to me, even when he's using, because I can at least work with him. And so at one point, he got into a housing program for people with mental health issues, and he wanted to keep that housing situation. So he made the choice to go to rehab because they had found some paraphernalia on him. So he goes to rehab, but he keeps seeing me for his mental health issues, and he says, just between me and you, I'm not ready to stop using. You know, I'm clean now, but when I get out, I want to keep using. So instead of chastising him, you know, I said, okay, so let's at least keep you alive. So let's come up with some out-of-the-box ways of looking how, if you want to keep using fentanyl, because if I said, no, that's absolutely ludicrous, he'd stop coming to me, right? And so I want him to keep coming back to me, even if he's doing things that are unhealthy. And it's not a choice. It's his addiction. It's his brain chemistry. So he finishes the 90-day program, and he comes sees me a couple days later. I'm like, okay, have you used yet? Because we haven't implemented our plan. And he's like, no, I haven't, and I don't want to. So he came to the decision himself, you know, and he still came back to me saying, I want to stay off opiates. And so I was able to give him a medicine that helps with cravings while you're off opiates, just in case if he did go back to opiates, he wouldn't overdose. But more, you know, also importantly to you know, keep his mental state about using on track. And so I saw him a few weeks ago, and he's 9 months off of all substances. And, you know, he's really proud of that. But he had to come to that himself. And I didn't make him feel like crap for the process that it took him. And so that's kind of an example of what a renegade is, because that's not your normal doctoring. And I one of the, you know, things about this book is I want medical people to pick up on that importance of accepting people where they're at and really working at them and not judging them for their addiction or their mental illness. I mean, this is, you know, it's like judging someone for, you know, being in type 1 insulin dependent diabetic. You know, it's just part of the chemistry that they are working with.
One of the things that occurs to me is, you know, as you talk early in the book about, you know, some of the poor folks you met and the resilience that they demonstrated and the resilience of children in particular, it occurs to me that, of course, it also takes resilience to do this work and to do this as long as you have done it. And it seems to me that that's also a part of this book, the resiliency, the relentlessness of your passion for your patients. And I so appreciate how effectively you tell that story. The book, again, is Renegade MD, A Doctor's Stories from the Streets, and the author, Dr. Susan Partovi. Dr. Partovi, thank you so much, first of all, for the great work that you do on behalf of so many people, and thank you for telling your story in this book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Aw, thank you. I really appreciate all your questions. Thank you so much.